Joining us on the WBGO Journal is playwright Tony Meneses, whose play The Women of Padilla. It's world premiere here at Two River Theater in Red Bank. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about The Women of Padilla. When it comes to this show, it's about eight women. You're a guy. How does a guy write a story about eight women in any circumstance?
Good question. Yeah, no, it's that one moment where you just have to have a lot of humility and being like, all right, what am I writing that's different than my own, but not being afraid of that challenge, because as writers, you have to sort of take on any kind of identity. Actually, one of the favorite quotes that I have is Virginia Woolf, how she didn't identify sometimes, or to paraphrase, she didn't identify solely as feminine or female, that she had to be able to become both male and female. That's always really inspired me, because I actually tend to write a lot of female characters in my work, mostly because that's sort of my upbringing. I have a strong matriarch figure. All of my aunts were strong women, influential women. So I just pulled what the universe gave me and used them as my creative input to make something of my own. So there were men in my life, but I think mostly it's been a lot of women. And also, like, my favorite authors are women. A lot of my tastes just happens to be very female oriented. So for me, it's something I don't even question. I just do it. And then if I need like some feedback, if I'm doing something a little, like if I'm taking a misstep as a man using the voice of a woman, I more than welcome that from like my collaborators, the actresses I've worked with, for example. But so far, it doesn't seem like I haven't done anything too boneheaded as far as like a guy writing a female voice.
And mom's still around?
Yes.
Okay, so let's before we get into the Women of Padilla, which runs through April 30th here at Two River Theater in the Recknitz Theater, let's talk about mom. You said she had such an influence on you. Do you remember the first time you showed her anything that you wrote?
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't come into writing until like high school, college. So she saw a play of mine that I wrote in undergrad. And I went to grad school right after undergrad too. She saw those shows. So she always asked like some of those plays that I don't even pay attention to anymore. Like, oh, how's that show doing? I'm like, I don't know. It's in a drawer. But yeah, she's a huge supporter, a huge advocate for my work. So yeah.
And you were born in Guadalajara, Mexico, raised in Albuquerque and Dallas, and spent your college time in Austin, as you mentioned, University of Texas, Austin. So for you, The Women of Padilla, talk about how this all came about and give us a real short synopsis of what the play is all about.
Yeah, so I wrote this when I was in graduate school. I went to the University of Iowa, and thanks to that opportunity, they had, you know, I was well-funded to do some trips to Guadalajara, which I hadn't been to. I hadn't been able to afford since I was like a child. So I just took it upon myself to see my family there that I haven't seen in like a decade. And it was there that I re-met all of my aunts that I always just heard so many great stories about, but then got that firsthand experience. So actually, sort of a fun sidebar, all of the women in the play are named after each of my aunts and my mother. These are actual real women. Those are their real personalities. Fictionalized, it's a different story. It's not biographical, but it is the essence of each woman. The soul of each woman is in each of these characters. So obviously they were directly responsible for this show. And also at the time of writing the show, it was like, all right, I have this library of women who have these fascinating stories. How do I marry that into a story that I should tell right now? And we were pretty much like knee deep, if not further, in the Iraq War at the time. And a lot of my colleagues, a lot of the work coming out of New York were stories about war and contending with that in an artistic way. And for me, I thought, you know, it didn't feel organic to tell like a soldier story, which is a lot of what was happening at the time. Sort of that felt like an experience I didn't know how to speak to intimately. But I did think about like women on the home front, you know, the sort of fictionalized war of women waiting for their husbands to come back, or for the names of those that have fallen in battle to come back. So I thought, all right, let me just use the point of view and these women as a way to tell that story. So I sort of married sort of my global consciousness with my family story and sort of created the show out of both of those things.
What a great idea to have that marriage of your two worlds come together, and kind of really like almost a love letter to your family members back home. What's been their reaction? I know it's been several years now, but what's been their reaction?
You know, it's fun because it's almost in the promotional material, you have to kind of sum up each woman with a one-liner just to give them an essence of who they are. So I have, for example, my Aunt Carmen. She is this life of the party, jovial woman who I made the drunk in the play. When she was younger, she tells these awesome stories of her and my mom getting like wasted, and you know, getting into trouble. So I use that as sort of her like moniker, but she's like, "Oh my God, you made me the drunk." I'm like, no, you're like the life of the party. You're the character that every actress wants to play." So that sort of seems to have assuaged her anxiety about her perception. But yeah, everyone else has been really supportive and welcoming. You know, it's in my family in Guadalajara, a lot of us are working. I mean, we're working class people. So to have someone in the family that's doing this, an arts career, and you know, actually having that career and working, I think they're just really supportive for that alone. It's just it's fun to have somebody else doing something different than sort of the family trade.
I know it's hard to run down 8 women at one time, but if you could tell us the names of the actresses, just a little bit about them.
Yeah, so we have Jacqueline Correa playing Mari, who's actually my mom. She's sort of the matriarch of this group of women. We have Daniela de Jesus, who plays Fidela. She's sort of the quiet one who sort of sticks to the sidelines, but is always there. We have Helen Cespedes, who's playing Lucha. She's the poet of the group and the character that I relate to the most, someone that tries to deal with the conflicts of the world in an artistic way and to make something out of that. Karina Arroyava plays Blanca, who's the literal outsider of the world. She does not participate in the group of women, and she's very cool with that. You know, she doesn't need them in the way that they need each other, which happens in every family. There's always that one that's sort of on the outliers of everything else. We have Paloma Guzman, who's playing Alejandra. She's sort of the young, hopeful, soon-to-be mother who still sees the world optimistically, even though their times are full of darkness and despair. We have Karen Lugo playing Marta, who's the pious religious one, sometimes annoyingly so. We have Elizabeth Ramos playing Christina. She's sort of the young one, a little bit of brat sometimes, the sort of this young wife that they got stuck with all of a sudden. And then Janine Sorales is playing Carmen, who's that aforementioned drunk aunt who's the life of the party. She's definitely the most memorable character and the most fun character to write to because she sort of says whatever's on her mind.
And you made it purposely to have it as an unnamed war.
Yeah, so, you know, pulling from inspiration of the rules of magical realism, especially Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who sort of makes up his own worlds and his own rules to those worlds, I thought, let me just use those principles for this show. And not sort of bog down the play with a specific war history, but just let it be sort of this ongoing, nameless war that really is, for me, commenting on the fact that war is a never-ending cycle. It's human history from the very beginning. It's our history now. We're living it today. So for me, it's a timeless show in that way, and trying to be a timeless show on purpose. You know, there's not a year that this play is set in for that reason. Because I do think, you know, the show could be done 50 years ago, it could be done 50 years from now, and I think we're still going to relate to how we sometimes engage in heightened conflict like war and why war exists and how we process it and what we do with it.
And even as we speak, today is the day of the U.S. bombing in Afghanistan, so people are thinking about that. And, you know, it's interesting, I've always wondered about the weight, whether you're a male or a female, if you have a loved one in the military, that weight has to be excruciating, especially when you have something that happens today. Is my loved one coming back?
Yeah, and it's a huge responsibility because for me, you know, I don't have a military experience in my family. None of us served in the military. I don't know what that's like. So I do feel a responsibility to tell that story truthfully and fairly. But, you know, even for, you know, you have to take on the perspective of that. And I actually am very viscerally reminded. I was 18 when September 11th happened, about to be 18, about to go to school. And we didn't know what was about to happen. That was such a big turning moment in our history that I really thought, like, what if this becomes like a 1960s conscription thing again? And I really just adopted that mindset. Like, what would that feel like? What would my mother feel like knowing that I was the youngest of four, having to worry about me in that way? And then having friends who, you know, have had more of an intimate relationship with the military and getting their perspectives has been helpful through the years. One of my graduate colleagues was also in the military. So yeah, you know, it's something that I don't want to get wrong, and I want to be truthful, and I want to just give a human story to it without making assumptions or judgments. I know we all have perspectives about war and our role in it as Americans specifically. So it's just to give an open-ended conversation about different characters who have different opinions about it that then makes the audience engage in that too. Like, do I feel like her in her perspective about war, or do I feel like the other woman down the table who has that perspective? I think that's what art should do, is to ask questions rather than, you know, give answers or make declarative statements about the state of the world. I don't think that's the point of art or theater.
We all react differently about losing loved ones. What was it like for you when you lost your father?
I think for me, you know, as an artist, it was a point, which was like 10 years ago, so it was a while back. But when it had happened, you know, you just, it's a grief is so funny that sometimes it just, as someone that processes things with words, to not have words suddenly. But then knowing that eventually I was going to have to cope with words as a playwright. So eventually it started to come out in my work. It comes out in this play and other plays that I've written, the notions of grief and how I dealt with that in my life. But it's just, you know, that's how I understand the world in good moments and bad moments is art, it's theater. So it comes out, of course it comes out in that regard too. So it's certainly something that I pull from and use depending on the story, depending on the play.
You're no stranger to Two River Theater. Your play, Guadalupe in the Guest Room, had its world premiere here in this theater as well. So tell us a little bit about that play and what it meant now to have another production here at Two River.
Yeah, this play, Guadalupe in the Guest Room, was my first professional production in my career, so a huge turning point in terms of sort of the hustle of living in New York, trying to be a playwright, sort of that first real production that I've had in my career. So, you know, I'm always going to take that with me forever, that, you know, this theater was the first theater to say, yes, yeah, we believe in you, we believe in your work, we believe in your voice, come on over, make a play. So that was a hugely special moment in my career. And then to have them have me back 2 years later is really a surprise to me. I wouldn't think that they would have me back so soon, but it's nice that they have taken so much investment in me to have me here again with another show. Two River Theater has been incredibly generous and supportive. It does feel like a creative home at this point. This is someplace that I can come to and make work try different things and be challenged and grow as a writer, because I'm still obviously a young writer growing and figuring out his point of view.
Guadalupe, her story is an interesting one.
Yeah, so this particular play was about a woman, a Latina woman, a Mexican woman in her 60s who loses her adult daughter to illness, and it's about her relationship with her daughter's husband, who happens to be a white American guy who only speaks English. She mostly only speaks Spanish, so the two of them really have no language between them, and yet they both have this same grief that they're both dealing with. So the play follows their relationship. At first, you know, they couldn't be further apart, but then they end up bonding, strangely enough, over a Spanish telenovela that she watches. He starts watching it with her just to keep her company, and then he gets sucked into it the way novellas happen to do that. And we see sort of the play within the play, the novella within the play, and the two end up bridging their divides and really come to understand and appreciate and respect each other's perspectives about the loss that they just experienced and their perspectives about the world that they're living in.
We're speaking with Tony Meneses, the playwright of The Women of Padilla. It's running through April 30th here at Two River Theater in Red Bank and the Recknitz Theater. Are you happy that there's a translation version that's coming up on Monday?
Yeah, so for me with The Women of Padilla, you know, I grew up speaking Spanish first. That was the language that I learned first, and then I learned English. But I've never translated my work, or I tried, and it's a challenge. It's like using a whole other part of your brain. So I'm happy someone else did the translation, because that's a lot of work. And for me, what's really special about it is my mom, who's here in town to watch the play and to be here for opening night. We're gonna hang out and come back to that, because, you know, she's more comfortable in Spanish than English. So for her to really hear the words that I wrote and fully understand them, I think that's going to be such a really special gift, as well as other audiences. You know, Red Bank has a big Latino, a big Mexican population, so I hope they come out too, just hear the play in a very accessible way to them in their own language.
What a wonderful moment that'll be for you and your mom. You were born in Guadalajara, Mexico, raised in Albuquerque and Dallas, and spent your time in Iowa, your student work, as well as the University of Texas at Austin. What I wanted to talk to you about is that in 2010, really validation that you are indeed a terrific playwright. At a very young age for you, the Kennedy Center, 2010 Kennedy Center ACTF Latino Playwriting Award. What did that mean to you?
Well, at that time, I was about to graduate from my program in Iowa and step into the real world for the first time, and not as a student. So, you know, as an artist, you don't know what's going to happen. It's really, you know, it's timing and luck. That's sort of the refrain that we're used to. So I didn't know what was going to happen as soon as I left school, and I happened to get this award, I think in March before I graduated, and it sort of just felt, it was just a really affirming moment to think like, wow, I really can do this. I think I can do this. You know, someone else is telling me I can do this, so let me believe that too. So it was hugely influential in just affirming the decision to move to New York to give this a go, to try to be a playwright in the 7 years since that award and the other, you know, since graduating and the other sort of accolades that have come along the way. It's been nice to remember things like that and sort of my beginnings and sort of appreciate the fact that I really am doing something that I didn't know if it was going to happen or not. And that award was sort of one of those first moments to say, yes, you can do this.
Who at Iowa, when you got that honor, do you say this is one of the reasons why I became who I am as a playwright?
All of them, to be honest. The two directors of the program are Derek Klubb, who's a playwright, and Art Bereka, who is a dramaturg. And I think the greatest gift that they gave all of us was space and freedom to do whatever we wanted and then to bring in our work, to figure it out, to make mistakes and try new things. You know, when I was in Iowa, I was a very young writer, a very young person. So I didn't have a point of view quite yet, I don't think. But I learned through just trying different things and getting their feedback and their encouragement and their questions allowed me to find my track and point of view. So I would say those two guys were really influential in that regard because they were supportive no matter what. And they, you know, they never would make us stop working on a play. They would never say, no, that's not a good idea. They would encourage us to the point that we realize that for ourselves, what's worth working on and what's worth growing into.
Another thing is in your growing career already, you know, you reminded me of something that Ruben Santiago Hudson, who has directed many plays here for Two River Theater, about providing a voice and opportunity for people of color in theater. Not having, you mentioned how many of the times these eight ladies may be competing for one role in one play, and here they are all able to be in one show together. He talks about how, you know, when he was working on Jitney and being able to give some roles, you know, even on the Broadway production, giving some roles to some actors. So, you know, I think that's why it's so important that we have people like you, Tony, in the arts.
Yeah, you know, it's... It definitely allows me to work more confidently, knowing that actually what I'm doing is more important than me, bigger than me. You know, what I have to offer as a Latino writer is a point of view, especially now in a moment where, you know, my specific experience is growing up as a Mexican immigrant. You know, we came here illegally. We became citizens through the years. But that's such a huge conversation right now. It's like, well, who are these people who are coming here? We're sort of otherized to the point where our humanity is denied. So then as an artist, my bread and butter is humanity. That's what I do. So then to give characters and voices a platform to be themselves, to live their lives, to understand their troubles and their sufferings. And then for our audiences, wherever the background may be, to then see that and be like, oh, wow, I understand. I understand this woman who can't speak English. I actually feel for her. I understand these group of women dealing with grief and loss. They may not be like me, but I'm connecting to them. And I think that's the power of art. That's the power of theater. You know, you hear that refrain about universal storytelling. But I think when art is done truthfully and when it's done well, anyone from any experience, any walk of life, male, female, racial divides that are created, I think we can all access a shared humanity and a shared language about what it's like to actually just sort of be on this earth together and to share a common ground about what we all have to deal with, what we all have to struggle with as human beings. So, you know, being Mexican, being an immigrant, is how I can communicate that and how I can hopefully help bridge and demystify a lot of misunderstanding about what it's like to be someone like me.
Keeping on that political landscape a little bit, the National Endowment for the Arts, you know, the Kennedy Center and places like that rely on much from the National Endowment for the Arts. You want to comment on the uncertainty of that right now?
I mean, for the longest time, and this is even before even I got into theater, I've always heard, you know, theater will die one day. And I know that's just not true. So regardless about NEA funding and how politicized that might be, run-ins we have with this administration on whatever thing we want to insert the blank with, I think as a human community, we will survive this. The NEA, I think we'll survive as an institution. I think it's already getting such a huge amount of like communal support and people are speaking up for it and advocating for it. So it would be a shame if it got lost. But I do think as artists, we know how to deal with punches when they're thrown at us, and we will make art no matter what.
Not only residents here at Two River Theater, but also the Denver Center Theater keeps you quite busy, I would imagine. You're on two different ends of the U.S.
Yeah, so this is a new piece of good news that came my way. I've just been commissioned in Denver for their theater, Denver Center Theater. They have an annual new play summit, so I'll be writing a new play for them this year, and then hopefully presenting that at some point soon. And I have a commission here with Two River as well. So it's nice that these theaters are investing in my voice. They don't even know what the play is, but they're saying, we like what you have to say. We like your point of view. Why don't you write us something? So yeah, it's a nice busy time, but you know, this is sort of what the hustle is for. You work so hard for so many years to get to this point. So, I'm elated to be where I'm at right now.
And you mention it so nonchalantly. I just write a play. How long does it take you to write a play? I would imagine it differs. Yeah. You know, for Women of Padilla, there's a lot of emotion coming from your family there. I imagine that took you quite some time.
This one actually, Padilla, it took me about a whole semester to write the first draft. I was rewriting it today. there's still just changes that you're always just kind of playing with the shape of it, with the words that you're using. So this has been a play that's been 8 years in the making, 9 years maybe. It just depends on the play. Sometimes some of them are born very quickly. Sometimes it just takes longer. It really just depends. I actually just wrote the longest play I've ever written at 175 pages this past fall, and I wrote it from the summer until early October. So it took about 4 months, and it was a very challenging gestation period just because it was so long. But yeah, sometimes they're written. I've written plays in like a weekend. I've written plays over the span of like 2 years. So it really depends.
One of the things why I think people are connecting to Women of Padilla and your work is that there are stories about real life. You know, we had mentioned Ruben Santiago Hudson directing the wonderful works of August Wilson's Jitney and the wonderful cycle of plays. August Wilson, they were real people in the Pittsburgh area telling real stories. I just saw Idina Menzel perform at the Sands in Bethlehem, and during that show and every show that she does a tribute to the late Jonathan Larson, who was the playwright of Rent, who she starred in and also was in the movie. Telling stories about real people, that's what it's all about. That's why we connect. We do it in radio. That's what you do.
Yeah, I think truth is the whole point of art. You know, it's funny because it's sort of like an oxymoron. You're making up a lie, a fictionalized story to ultimately tell a real life truth about our lives. But it's in that funky, wacky math that somehow, you know, we do create something that as an audience, we know when it's truthful. And it's hard to put into like tangible terms. I think when we see something that is untruthful, we kind of like, I don't buy it. But when we do see something that we know just comes from this wealth of truth of whoever created that, we sense it, we intuit it. I think it's like a sixth sense, we just get it. For me in this play, I think why it's had the life that it has had is because all of these women are inspired by actual aunts. They are named after my aunts and my mother. I think I'm happy that that is coming across, that they see them and know, that's a real person, that's a human being. And I think, in any play that I could ever aspire to write, it's just about truth. And whether they're real life figures in my life or not, you want to be inspired by those real figures and create whatever you need to get at something that's an important story to tell.
I don't want you to give away anything about the plot, but is there a moment where the smile comes upon Tony Meneses' face saying, yeah, it's happening in this production right now, and I can see it in the audience's face?
Yeah, no, actually, I have to. That's such a great question because, as I mentioned before, I've seen different various productions of the show before. I've seen school productions. There was a storefront production in Chicago, and there's this one thing in the play that this is the first time we're doing it. It's a design choice. It's the first time we're doing it this certain kind of way, and it's actually drawing audible gasps from the audience. I think it's very visceral. It's surprising. It's a little shocking. And again, I can't say what that is, but it's the most responsive audience I've ever seen to this play, because we're using a very different way of solving one of the play's biggest mysteries. And it's just so surprising. It just catches the audience off guard. It comes halfway through the show, and suddenly the audience is like, what just happened? What is this? So it's sort of a big, fun moment to anticipate night after night while we're in previews to see how the audience is going to react. And so far, it's very vocal and very visceral.
You mentioned the key word there. For you, it has to be so much fun to see the evolution of your pieces. You're saying, you know, I'm rewriting as, you know, today, Doug, I was rewriting it. Never quite satisfied, always wanting just something better, huh?
I think, yeah, for me, especially when you're in production, you know, when I'm just alone with the page, you get in your head and you edit along the way, and you just, of course, you want to be perfect, but it never will be perfect. But once it gets into the rehearsal space and the rehearsal room with actors, there's something about me. I'd like to think that I'm like a generous soul generally, but for me, I really take very seriously the questions I get from my actors, my actresses in this show, my director, my designers, that we all are making this together. You know, the last thing I want to be is that playwright that sort of is like my way or the highway. I mean, I'd like to think that, especially now in contemporary theater, no one is like that. No one really has that ego about them. We all know what it's like to make work together. So often the changes that I make are born out of questions I get from my collaborators. Like, well, I don't really get why she's saying this in this moment based on what she said so far. So then I'll look at that piece of text and try to answer that question for them, and then together we sort of find a common denominator of what feels most truthful to this character, because that's what they're trying to do too as actors, is like they're trying to live the truth of that person and asking their own critical questions of what that means. So that's what I love about rehearsal, is that it really kind of allows you to open up the play in ways that you by yourself can never do. You know, you have the skeleton and they're like the flesh, and then there's all this stuff that makes the composition of the whole thing. So a lot of the changes that I love making is as a result of questions from my collaborators, my director, my actors.
Let's talk briefly about your director, if we could. Ken Russ Schmall.
A genius, literally. When I first got to New York, one of the best pieces of advice I got was remember directors' names, so that when you get an opportunity to work with someone, you know them. So Ken Russ Schmall was someone whose work I saw very early on in New York, and being blown away by his point of view and his hand and how he makes work. And something that's specifically for this play, because there's magical realism elements to it. I wanted someone that has a real sense of vision, someone that just isn't just staging a play, trying to make just like a piece of realism, trying to like a slice of life story. This play is not that. So I want someone who has an imagination and who has a creative spirit. And Ken is that and beyond. He really sees the world beyond sort of the trees. He sees the forest, to use that metaphor. So yeah, he's been a dream collaborator, someone that I would work with a bazillion times if I could. He just asks really smart questions. He's such a rigorous director in his own craft, and the work that he gets out of the actors is beautiful to watch. He creates a safe space for all of them to ask their own questions. So yeah, he's sort of our fearless leader in this process.
Now, obviously, there's going to be different ages and different colors of the people who leave this theater. But let's just single out women. A couple of women come to the show. They get into their car after seeing The Women of Padilla. What do you want that conversation to be on the way home?
I mean, for me, I hope they relate to the different points of view, because, eight women aren't all going to have the same ideas about anything as any people, male or female, would have. You can't get them all to agree on things all the time. So what I hope they walk away from is just getting, first and foremost, just like a human perspective, how all these women think about the world. And then to be like, oh, right, they were also women. They happened to be women telling this story. But I hope that they connect to the fact that they understand their plight in their own way, even though they may not be Latino or not. I hope that they get to connect to them and use that as like a sense of empowerment. You know, like how badass that we just saw a show with eight women in it. That doesn't happen very often. So I guess maybe that's a better answer, is I hope they feel affirmed to know that this theater cares about those kinds of conversations, those kinds of questions that, you know, my director and I care about those kinds of conversations. And we just want to create an opportunity and a platform for a different kind of perspective that doesn't happen all the time. And, you know, an all-female show doesn't happen very often. So I hope that they do feel encouraged to know that that work is being created.
Your mom, as you mentioned, is going to be in the audience to see the premiere, going to be there for the translation. What would be the most wonderful words that you would hear from her in her own way to you that, you know, just saying, all this has been worth it?
Yeah, no, for me, she's such an advocate, but she's such an advocate at a distance. You know, she doesn't live near me. She lives in Guadalajara. She spends some time in Miami with my sister who lives out there. So for me, whether she uses the exact terms or not, to give voice to the fact that, like, the sacrifice is worth it, you know, because I live out here with no family near me. I create my own family, kind of with the themes of the show. But to have her understand and appreciate the fact that this is the work that I'm doing is worth that distance, worth that time away from her, would be incredibly validating for me to sort of realize that the work is the thing. The work is the thing that we're trying to make the world a better place. And I think she gets that, and I think she appreciates that. I'm sure she wants me around more than I am around, and appreciates the time that we are together. But yeah, I think that would be the most, like, incredibly affirming thing to hear from her, is like, yeah, this is good. Keep going. You know, keep working at this.
And you do realize that maybe it's already happened many times for you, but there's some young man, some young woman, or even littler in Guadalajara that's going to say, I want to be the next Tony Meneses. That's pretty powerful.
I mean, I would love nothing more than that. Yeah. I mean, anything, any underrepresented community, I would love to inspire, whether that's, you know, Latino or et cetera, because we do need those voices right now. And I think it's an important moment to have representation, to have a point of view about what it's like to be an underrepresented community and part of that. So, yeah, I mean, it's certainly what got me into art was people who made work that wasn't what I was just used to seeing, Latino points of view and other points of view. It let me know that I can exist as well, and that my story is worth telling to a larger audience. So I hope I'm doing that as well in my own way.
The Women of Padilla, running through April 30th here at Two River Theater in Red Bank in the Recknitz Theater. Tony, wonderful having you on the show. Thanks for inspiring so many, and we wish you the best of luck with your career.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me here.